This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
She outlined a few of her main concerns with the company's practices.
If I could change anything, I'd like to see them provide fair wages for their workers, and as part of that, provide them the hours that would get them fair wages. I'd like to see them not rely on federal health care, actually provide health care for the employees. And by provide, I mean provide health care that they can actually afford. Walmart's 2012 health care plans cost their employees between 77% and 104% of their employees' annual gross income. So that doesn't seem sustainable.
Vasek also spoke about some of the effects that the new Walmart will have specifically in Tigard.
Fano Creek runs right through that area, and Walmart will be paving a good portion of it. I know a part of their plan is to preserve some of the wetlands and have sort of a pass through the wetlands that are there, but a good majority of that area will get paved, and that water source, we believe, we're still researching, but we believe it actually runs as part of the Fano Creek. That potentially could be very destructive. Walmart's footprint on the environment in general is of a concern as well, given that a lot of things happen when you have a business of that size anywhere. It has a lot of impact on the environment, and it just makes it all the more dangerous that it's that close to a wetland.
She also outlined some of their main goals for the protest.
One of our main goals is just to educate people that that's what's going into that site. We have people in our group that have become very active, myself included, that up until 3 weeks ago, we somehow had even missed the boat on finding out that that was what was going into that site. So we had a couple people stop and say, is that where that new Walmart is going to be? We didn't even know. So really education is primary. Also spreading the word that there are other people in the community that are opposed to this.
While the group has not come into contact with any Walmart executives, they hope to speak with a representative at the Community Participation Organization meeting for the Tigard area next week. For KBOO News, I'm Audrey Davis.
The Portland City Council held a hearing this morning regarding the latest proposed increases to water and sewer rates. While the new rates unveiled last month by Mayor Charlie Hales are considerably less than the nearly 15% increase proposed last year, some activists are rallying against any rate increase. KBOO's Rebecca Ney has the story.
On April 30th, Charlie Hales revealed his first proposed budget as Portland's mayor. Aimed at addressing Portland's reported $21.5 million deficit, part of the plan calls for diverting money from public safety to pay for housing and social service programs. While this realignment of public funds has received little public outcry, according to the Portland Mercury, water and sewer rates are still on the rise, which was the focus of this morning's city council meeting. Under the mayor's plan, water rates will rise by 3.6% and sewer rates will climb by 5.3%. These rate increases are unnecessary, according to Kent Crayford from the Portland Water Users Coalition.
Portland doesn't need higher water and sewer rates. Our water and sewer rates are already some of the highest in the nation. We have seen water rates rise by 133% since 2000. We've seen sewer rates rise by 147% since 2000. We now have higher water rates than Phoenix, Arizona, a city in the desert. And a lot of these monies, Rebecca, are going to pay for projects that are completely unnecessary, like new reservoir tanks at Powell Butte and Kelly Butte, when we have perfectly well-functioning reservoirs at Mount Tabor and Washington Park. We're paying for a $40 million Taj Mahal headquarters building for the Water Bureau at a cost of $289 a square foot. So, you know, we're raising rates not because, of real pressing infrastructure needs. We're raising money and rates for pet projects, unnecessary projects, and we think it needs to stop.
In a May 8th editorial in the Oregonian newspaper, Mayor Charlie Hales defended his budget in regards to the new utility rates. The mayor compared his proposed increases to the 14.8% increase discussed last year. Hales says that rate increases are necessary because of, quote, miles and miles of pipes, close quote, that are between 75 and 100 years old. The mayor also justified the rate increase to pay for, quote, large capital projects, close quote, that were approved before he took office. Here is more from Crayford on some of those projects.
The Water Bureau, for instance, is proposing a seventh crossing under the Willamette River. We already have six. Do we really need a seventh? Water consumption in the city of Portland has been declining for 20, 25 years. I'll tell you the one thing that was disappointing to hear at the city council meeting this morning was the city council throwing up their hands on trying to save our historic open drinking water reservoirs. The attitude was seemingly, well, it's a state issue. There's nothing we can do. And that couldn't be further from the truth. New York City got a reprieve for their reservoirs. Rochester, New York got a reprieve for their reservoirs. Portland can and must still get a reprieve for our historic reservoirs. Where there's a will, there's a way. The question we have is whether there's a will on the Portland City Council. I don't know.
The continued increase in sewer rates is also a contentious issue, especially considering that the mayor plans to shift $2 million from the Bureau of Environmental Services to the city's general fund. Bob Salinger, the conservation director from the Audubon Society of Portland, says the current sewer rates are justified and worries about the environmental impact of cuts to the Bureau.
Sewer bills are going up, but they're not going to go up as much as was anticipated. And the reason that our rates are somewhat high right now is because we're still paying off the Big Pipe project. That was the project to get our sewers from overflowing into the river. It was a $1.4 billion project with more than a decade to complete. It was completed last year, but we're still paying off the debt from that, and that's why our rates are somewhat high. And so the mayor wanted to reduce the amount of increases, and so he made some cuts. We don't necessarily oppose reducing rates. What we are concerned about is the disproportionate impact on environmental programs. And the perception that was put out there that the Bureau of Environmental Services is no longer really going to be an environmental agency, that instead it's just going to go back to being a sewer bureau. Part of the reason Portland is as green and as healthy as it is today and it still has a long way to go is because we have that agency. And so seeing that gutted was really a problem.
The proposed budget is scheduled to be adopted by the City Council on June 20th. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
Nearly half of young workers in Oregon can expect to feel the recession's pinch for another decade or more, according to a new report generated by a youth advocacy organization called Young Invincibles. The study suggests that workers aged between 18 and 34 face a combination of stagnant wages and a void of opportunity that doesn't keep pace with what it costs to live in Oregon. For more on the report, KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke to Young Invincibles State Outreach and Policy Coordinator Brian Burrell.
Can you tell me how the data for your statistical information was generated?
It's mostly done through the Census and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The Census we use to pull some of the income data, the employment population ratio data, and the proportion of workers. But for some of the state averages, for both 16 to 24 and the overall state rate, that's from the local area unemployment statistics.
And did you do a state by state for the whole country?
Yes, we're currently releasing sort of the facts about youth unemployment for all 50 states.
And where do you think Oregon stacks up?
Well, at least in terms of the overall unemployment rate, the statewide rate is still higher than the national unemployment rate, as well as for the young adults, it's a little bit higher there. So Oregon does seem to have a little bit of a higher unemployment rate for young adults. So that it's not the worst, but it's definitely not the best by any means.
Over the 6 years covered in your graphs, from 2005 to 2011, incomes are only $240 higher per year. If you kind of apply that against the pace of increases in the cost of living, what does that do to the gap?
And that's one of the things that we've kind of been working on, in that incomes have very, very, very slightly improved. They've pretty much been stagnating. But on top of that, costs are going up, as you said, for the cost of living, transportation costs, healthcare costs, food costs, pretty much everything continues to go up. But the young adult entry-level wages have pretty much been stuck the same, so it just makes it harder and harder for young adults to get by. And that's why we're really looking to sort of expand the economic opportunity for young adults and make people aware of this so that they realize what issues this could pose for the millennial generation. The narrative that the national economy is recovering, but people aren't necessarily focusing on the fact that 18 to 34-year-olds haven't really been a part of that. So just number one, making sure that people know it hasn't been all rosy for young adults. There's still a long way to go. And then from there, working with them to expand job training programs and educate people about what really needs to be done to sort of solve this economic crisis.
Nearly every statistic shows a big dip in 2009. Mm-hmm. With a slight jump back up since, but not recovered to 2005 levels, and even mm-hmm. that seems to have leveled off. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the consequences if these figures remain flat, or worse yet, further recede?
We actually put out a report last August. I have to double-check the figures, but just currently on the process of job recovery that we're going on, it could be, I believe, until about 2021, until we get back to just pre-recession levels for young adults. And that's assuming, you know, we don't fall further behind and that everything has a smooth economic recovery. So it could be a very, very long time before young adults are back on path to really sort of enjoy the economic recovery that the rest of the country has been making.
According to the 2010 census, the age bracket covered in your data suggests this segment of the Oregon population is roughly about 780,000 people, and at 45% of them underemployed, this amounts to somewhere in the neighborhood of 350,000 people just in this state. The graphic information you had suggested that these are the ingredients for dim career prospects. Where do you see the harshest economic impact?
Number one, currently there are a large number of young adults that just don't have jobs. As you can see in Oregon, for 16 to 24-year-olds, about 18% of people do not have jobs right now. So that's issue number one, just making sure that these people have access to jobs. But number two, starting out your career with lower wages, with lower access to opportunities, can actually limit you even farther down the line. There was a recent study by the Center for American Progress where they found that if you're unemployed for 6 months or longer, and ages 20 to 24, you can lose $22,000 in future wages over the next decade. And so for the people in 2010, the height of sort of youth unemployment, there's a potential loss of $21 billion of wages over 10 years. Visit us at younginvincibles.org. Contact us if you have any questions or you're interested in working together with us.
I'm Robin Ryan, and this is KBOO News.
Today, a U.S. committee rejected an amendment to the Farm Bill that would have prevented cuts to the food stamp program, which provides food assistance to poor and working families. The House version of the Farm Bill calls for a $2.5 billion cut from the food stamp budget per year. This would affect one in seven Americans who currently use food stamps. The cuts are a part of the Farm Bill, which was supposed to have passed in December, but got delayed because of partisan politics. Republicans argue that the cut on food stamps is relatively small compared to its total budget of $80 billion a year. They say that most people who qualify for food stamps could still obtain them, they just wouldn't be added automatically. However, Democrats argue that taking food stamps from people will only make them more vulnerable and more miserable as the economic situation in the U.S. continues to remain unstable.
Another delay was announced today in the delivery of two streetcars from the Clackamas-based manufacturer United Streetcar. The company bills itself as the only streetcar manufacturer based in the United States, and its first prototype streetcar, which hit Portland streets in January, is plastered with the words "Made in the USA." But United Streetcar has faced problems with meeting production deadlines. In Portland last fall, the opening of the new streetcar line was delayed to allow the company more time, but ended up opening without the locally built streetcars that had been promised. United Streetcar was not able to deliver on its promises. Now the first two regulation streetcars produced by the company are apparently almost ready. Although they were supposed to be in service this week, the date has been postponed again until next week. United Streetcar has been criticized for failing to deliver streetcars on time to Tucson, Arizona, and to Washington, D.C. as well. Portland city officials have also come under fire for stepping in to help Washington, D.C. renegotiate with the company after the original deal fell through.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Occupy Radio at 6, with an exploration of our current financial situation and what we can do about it. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy, with a high temperature of 67 degrees Fahrenheit and a 40% chance of rain.
It's 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Step right up, folks, and take your chances in the amazing new American workplace. Constantly high unemployment, low wages always, no employee bargaining power, a corporate paradise. This paradise has enriched the already rich investor elite and rewarded top executives with multimillion-dollar pay packages. It also lets corporations treat the masses of people in today's workforce like Kleenexes. Just use them up and toss them. After all, they're cheap, plentiful, and disposable. Indeed, taskmasters in suits have now redefined the term hired to mean that you're tethered to a corporation full-time, but you actually work and get paid for only the few hours a week when the boss calls. This nefarious practice, known as on-call shifts, is all the rage among national retail chains. Such giants as Abercrombie & Fitch, Gap, and Urban Outfitters require employees to work without set schedules and to be available to have their string yanked at any time, day or night, even on weekends, with as little as 2 hours' notice. Likewise, if customer traffic in a store is slow, retail workers who got dressed up, battled the morning commute, and reported on time can simply be sent away after an hour or so, with no pay for their lost hours. A recent survey of some 400 retail employees in New York City found that only 17% have a set schedule. Those with no set hours also have no set income and no life. If you're at the beck and call of the boss, what do you do with your children? How do you make a doctor's appointment? What if you're taking a class or trying to work a second job? This is Jim Hightower saying, this shameful on-call practice says that the corporation owns you and that abuse of workers is a legitimate business practice in America. To help stop it, contact RetailActionProject.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A South Carolina couple has filed a lawsuit against a hospital for carrying out a gender assignment surgery on their 16-month-old son. The adoptive couple said that their child was intersex, but doctors decided to remove his penis in an attempt to force him to grow up as a girl. Their lawyer spoke at a press conference this morning announcing the lawsuit.
The medical record makes it clear that doctors felt that this child could be raised as a boy or as a girl, that there was no compelling reason to go either way. And why they decided to do irreversible genital surgery, knowing that, is unclear. It seems that they just assume that once you decide a child is a boy or a girl, you have to make its body fit stereotypes or ideals for that sex.
The child is now 8 years old and, although identified as a girl when he was first adopted, began to identify as a boy and is now being raised as a boy by his adoptive parents. The child's father also spoke at the press conference this morning.
We have our anxieties for how we raise him and about his future, but we try to help him focus on the positive opportunities our unique lives hold. By bringing a lawsuit against the defendants, we hope to put other doctors, hospitals, and state agencies on notice that they cannot mutilate children without being held accountable for the damage they cause.
Although gender assignment surgery is considered elective, the doctors in this case carried out the surgery on the child when he was 16 months old, after parental rights were terminated, but before he was adopted. Gender assignment surgeries at birth used to be extremely common, but parents in recent years are deciding to allow intersex children to decide their own gender before going through with what can be an irreversible surgery.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said today that the Obama administration might release all Yemeni prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay. Holder said the Obama White House is trying to send all detainees who have been cleared back to their home countries and that the block on freeing Yemeni prisoners is under review. Of the estimated 166 prisoners at Guantanamo, 91 are Yemeni, and most of those have been cleared for release. President Obama placed a block on all Yemeni prisoners scheduled for release because of an underwater bomb plot originating in Yemen. Both Holder and Obama reaffirmed their desires to close the Guantanamo prison recently. Holder said in a commencement speech at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, that Congress has placed, quote, unwarranted restrictions on where certain detainees could be housed, charged, and prosecuted. Obama said in a press conference that he restated his 2008 promise to close Guantanamo recently. A hunger strike by some of the detainees continues due to the failures of U.S. authorities to free prisoners who've been cleared for release.
89 medical professionals have been arrested under charges of falsely billing more than $220 million to the Medicare program. More than 1,500 people have been charged since the creation of the Medicare Fraud Strike Force in 2007. The so-called Strike Force is a joint effort shared between the Justice Department and Health and Human Services. Defendants face charges of conspiracy to commit health care fraud and money laundering, as well as for submitting claims for purchases, treatments, and services that federal officials claim were either medically unnecessary or never provided at all. 400 federal agents were involved in the national dragnet, which included arrests and raids in Miami, Los Angeles, Houston, New York City, Detroit, Chicago, Tampa Bay, and Baton Rouge. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and Health and Human Services Director Kathleen Sebelius said the arrests are a sign that the crackdown on Medicare fraud is working.
Columbia University has filed a court motion to amend the requirement that its Lydia Roberts Graduate Fellowship only go to white students. Lydia Roberts died in 1920 and left most of the money from her estate to Columbia University. She created several guidelines for the university to follow in order to use the money. She wrote that those awarded with the scholarship should be from Iowa, should not study law, and must be a person of Caucasian race. While the fellowship has been in place for nearly 100 years, Columbia has not issued the scholarship since 1997. Changing the condition of the request would require several steps involving the court. A 1949 attempt by the NAACP to overturn the race requirement failed when the university's provost at that time decided to defend the whites-only rule.
In the latest in a series of actions opposing the Keystone XL pipeline, two women who are members of Cross Timbers Earth First were arrested yesterday for chaining themselves to concrete barrels at a construction site in Oklahoma. The lockdown managed to stop construction for several hours until the women were removed by police. Members of Earth First are concerned about the environmental impact of the pipeline, which is scheduled to run from Alberta, Canada, to the Texas coastline. President Obama has final approval over the pipeline, but some Republican members of Congress are trying to sideline that process with a fast track that would not require the approval of the president. Protesters say that the tar sand extraction in Alberta is threatening local water resources, polluting communities, and violating Indigenous sovereignty. This demonstration is just one of an escalating number of actions occurring in the Oklahoma area, where construction of the massive Keystone XL pipeline is already underway.
35 people were killed in separate bombing attacks, mostly in Shiite areas of Baghdad and in northern areas of Iraq. The violence is an escalation of tensions between the Iraqi Sunni minority and the Shiite leadership of the country. 22 people were killed and dozens injured as car bombs rocked Baghdad today, including one in a market and another outside a cafe. Two bombs in Kirkuk killed another 10 people, and a suicide bomber in Mosul killed one policeman. Relations between Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish groups have grown strained since the U.S. pulled out of Iraq in 2011. The Syrian civil war, in which Sunni rebels are attempting to wrest control from Shiite Alawite President Bashar al-Assad, has further fueled hatred between Sunni and Shiite groups in Iraq. Al-Qaeda's local Iraqi group, the Islamic State of Iraq, and other Sunni insurgent groups have stepped up their activity against the Shiite government in recent weeks, using the Syrian civil war to gain legitimacy and to exploit frustrations of Iraqi Sunnis. Sunni insurgent groups carry out almost daily attacks to undermine the Iraqi government.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a bomb blast in the eastern city of Jalalabad wounded 9 people, including 5 police officers. Officials say the attack targeted security forces, but no group has taken responsibility for the bombing. 2 more bombs in Jalalabad killed 1 policeman and wounded at least 9 others. The twin blasts were near a heavily secured governor's compound and police checkpoint.
Today marks the 65th anniversary of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which the Palestinians call the Nakba, or catastrophe. At Portland State University, the Students for Palestinian Equal Rights have joined in an international divestment from the investment firm TIAA-CREF, which funds companies that profit from the occupation. KBOO's Chris Andres spoke this morning with PSU student organizer Jenna Sadam about the divestment campaign.
Why is TIAA-CREF is such a convenient target for the divest campaign?
Universities invest or usually have their retirement packages connected to TIAA-CREF, and so this is a great way for students to get involved and sort of pressure and organize the faculty to, you know, divest from TIAA-CREF. And so I think that's sort of like one of the best campaigns to connect to, because you can connect to, you know, ones that are happening, you know, in your own state as well as, you know, outside of Oregon.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, May 15, 2013. Palestinians mark Nakba Day with protests and soldiers attack them, leaving scores injured, and invade West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Thousands across the West Bank and Gaza marked on Wednesday the 65th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba. In Jerusalem, Israeli soldiers attacked residents and local activists using tear gas, water mixed with chemicals, and rubber-coated steel bullets. According to local sources, 20 residents were injured. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Medical sources reported that there were journalists among those injured in Jerusalem today. Moreover, Israeli soldiers attacked residents using horses and kidnapped 30 residents. In Jerusalem, people marched peacefully and raised Palestinian flags. The clashes started when troops attacked the unarmed protesters, witnesses told local news. At the city of Bethlehem, southern West Bank, the procession was held at the Manager Square in Bethlehem, while scout troops and more than 5,000 Palestinians marched carrying Palestinian flags and signs affirming the legitimate Palestinian rights, topped by their right to return to their homeland. In the central West Bank city of Ramallah, residents marched towards the Ofer Israeli military base at the city entrance. As soon as people marched at the main road, Israeli soldiers showered them with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. As a result, at least 30 people were injured, and many more were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Earlier on Wednesday at dawn, local sources reported that dozens of Israeli military jeeps invaded Zabuba town west of the northern West Bank city of Jenin and clashed with local youth. The army also invaded the nearby towns of Ramona and At-Taiba. The sources said that at least 6 armored Israeli military vehicles invaded Zabuba and that the soldiers broke into and searched dozens of homes adjacent to the annexation wall. The army also invaded the town center and clashed with dozens of local youth who hurled stones and empty bottles at them. Furthermore, the army invaded the nearby towns of Ramona and Taiba, closed various roads into the towns, stopped several vehicles and interrogated the residents while inspecting their ID cards. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, May 15th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Audrey Davis, Rebecca Ney, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Ben Renner. Special thanks to Chris Andre. Our engineer is Kurt Lauer. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 91.7 FM, on K264AA in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Nia Lewis. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty interviews acclaimed author Walter Mosley about his latest book, Little Green, and more. At 9, it's Pressed Watch, news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogering interviews Israeli-born musician and author Gilad Atzmon, who criticized